Okay. Welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee. I'll call the meeting to order. Today's Thursday, May 4th, 2006. It's now 2 minutes to the hour of 9 a.m. We have two items before us this morning, HJR 9 and SJR 17. We're going to put these kind of side by side today. And so we're going to look at this almost as a work session more than a formal hearing. Gabrielle Ledoux, Representative Ledoux, is here. She's one of the sponsors. Senator French is the other. Gabrielle, you're welcome to come to the table there. Let's kind of step our way through these. Senator French?
Mr. Chairman, I might be able to help the process by distributing a work draft. Okay. Of a proposed Senate CS.
All right.
And once you have that, I'll kind of explain what it does.
Okay, Senator French, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Senate CS backdraft golf is a proposed meshing, if you will, of the two resolutions before the committee today. I've spoken at some length with the sponsor of House Joint Resolution Number 9, and I don't think she has any objection to the proposal, which would basically take the Senate Joint Resolution and put it inside her House Joint Resolution and make one Exxon resolution, if you will, for the committee's consideration. So that's the idea, and I'd be happy to answer questions or defer to Representative Ledoux.
Representative Ledoux?
I think it's a great idea. I'm interested in doing anything that can help both of these Exxon resolutions advance to passage.
Okay, let's just step down through it. Senator French.
Mr. Chairman, on the document before you, which would also come with a concurrent resolution to accomplish the necessary title change, which I'll just distribute that in a few moments. I don't think it's anything controversial, but the resolution would urge the federal courts to refrain from enacting any legislation that would affect the outcome of the court's resolution of the case. I think the case, according to the memo we've got from Ms. Ledoux, is before the Ninth Circuit right at the moment. And the resolution would likewise urge the United States Department of Justice and the Alaska Department of Law to begin the process of pursuing the reopener clause, which we heard about yesterday. That clause, which was bargained for in the original settlement, is intended to cover the cost of unanticipated damages that were not anticipated at the time of the 1991 settlement. That's the title, the combined title. And as you can see on page one, the whereas clauses begin with a short recitation of the basic facts of the Exxon Valdez grounding back in March of 1989. Page two, the first whereas clause covers the short facts regarding the size of the spill and the amount of ground it covered. The whereas clause beginning on page two, line eight, sets out the fact that there was a civil settlement between the federal and state government and Exxon. The next whereas clause sets forth the basic fact of the reopener that was, as I mentioned, bargained for and needs to be pursued before September 1, 2006, or else it's forever waived. The next whereas clauses discuss the outline of Representative Ledoux's resolution, recounting the fact that there was a unanimous jury verdict of punitive damages, how the damages have are still tied up in litigation, that the damage claim is currently before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and the whereas clause spilling over from page 2 into page 3 covers the fact that Exxon Corporation once sought an amendment that would have substantially reduced their punitive damages. And I think that was the impetus, if you will, behind Representative Ledoux's resolution. The next whereas clause on page 3 shifts back to the reopener provision, categorizing some of the efforts that have been done by different state agencies and universities and so forth, looking into the spill since the time of its occurrence. And the next three whereas clauses, beginning on page 3, lines 8, 13, and 15, outline the some of the difficulties that have arisen since the brief at ease.
What's
turkeys?
We were on page 3, lines, the whereas clauses on lines 13, 15, and 18 state that there are some cost-effective restoration opportunities to mitigate the unanticipated damages, and that the governments are required to submit detailed plans for use of reopener funds 90 days before a formal request to the ExxonMobil Corporation, and that, again, that deadline date is September 1, 2006. Finally, the last whereas clause simply states that it's in the best interests of the citizens of Alaska that the governments assert this claim for full payment for the additional damages from the Exxon Valdez oil spill. The resolved clauses, again, combine the two resolutions. One respectfully urges the Congress to not enact any legislation that would delay the punitive damages awarded to more than 32,000 plaintiffs. And the next two resolved clauses urge the two governments to identify natural resource damages from the oil spill that were unanticipated and to report to the legislature on or before June 2nd the status of the government's claim for reopener damages. That's a walkthrough of the proposed Senate CS.
Okay. Now,
one thing on resolutions that sometimes concern me is the data in the whereas. How certain we are we that this is the data that's in the whereas?
Well, let's begin on the first page, Mr. Chairman. Just as an example, the 11,000 gallons of crude oil has been a topic of great discussion, and it's sort of the minimum figure that most newspaper accounts have seized on.
Okay.
11 million. Indeed, they're
gallons.
Yep. The documents, there are many assertions that the spill, in fact, was far larger, and that the initial estimate was sort of a thumbnail sketch that caught the public eye and stayed in the public eye. But there are many folks who would assert a larger spill. Likewise, I think I think the tankers carry. So you got to divide by 55, right?
40.
40. You're right. So 300,000, barrels. And I'm trying to remember the size of those tankers, but I think they're close to million barrel tankers.
Okay.
The next whereas clause on page 2, lines 2 through 7, stated, I think we heard this from one of the scientists that testified, that the basic size of the spill was 10,000 square miles and 1,300 miles of shoreline. The next two whereas clauses don't assert much in the way of, you know, black and white facts, with the exception of the second clause, which just lays out the mere presence of the reopener clause in the contract and the size, $100 million. The whereas clause beginning on page to line 19 was, is supported by the New York Times article that I distributed to the committee, and was, I think, substantiated by the account in that article of the of Mr. Riley, the then EPA director's, President Bush's EPA director, bargaining hard for that provision, and indeed nearly causing a disruption in the negotiations because of his insistence on that provision. The next facts in the whereas clauses, beginning on line 23, are from newspaper accounts of the jury verdict and the size of the award. And I think the math in line 26, page 2, is pretty clear. It's been 15, actually now, should we 16 years since the disaster. Mm-hmm. And now nearly 11 years, more than 11 years, after the original verdict, the victims are still awaiting resolution of the litigation.
Okay.
When we get to it, I guess I'd come back and propose amendments to those two numbers.
This is exactly why I don't have any faith in the court system.
It's certainly a good example. I mean, I'm not going to defend the system at this point. I think it's a good example of how you can.
Yeah, I mean, it appears to be
an endless battery of lawyers can keep you from achieving justice.
Yeah. Playground for lawyers.
Right.
The whereas clause on line 31 of page 2, spilling over to lines 1 and 2 of page 3, I would defer to the representative for substantiation of that assertion.
And I believe we have distributed a memo based upon information which we received from one of the chief attorneys in the Exxon Valdez case, indicating that oral argument before the Ninth Circuit took place on January 27, 2006. There still is no decision yet. And the oral argument can be viewed online at www.ca9.uscourts.gov.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You
said the Ninth Circuit has not rendered a decision?
It keeps going back and forth and back and forth, but right now it is again in the Ninth Circuit.
Which means another good reason for dissolution.
That's right.
I think there have been five, or maybe now six, trips to the Ninth Circuit on this case. The facts asserted in the whereas clause beginning on line 3, page 3, were buttressed, I believe, by the testimony we heard not only in this committee but in the Senate Resources Committee from two scientists who have worked on the spill. There was testimony, I guess I'd like to, I know, Mr. Chairman, you were present, but maybe for the benefit of Senator Huggins, I'd like to recount the testimony that we heard from a Dr. Jeep Rice in the previous committee, who spoke about the presence of oil, relatively unweathered oil, just below the surface in the intertidal zones and the beaches that he's examined. And he described digging down into those beaches and having the oil still be viscous or unviscous enough to pool up in those holes he would dig. That it's still moving, still relatively unweathered, and still able to flow into and out of the intertidal zone, which he pointed out is sort of one of these rich areas that lots of animals go to feed in, and that in turn can be consumed by predators. So he painted, I thought, a fairly compelling picture of the ongoing damages that were not envisioned at the time of the spill. I think the prevailing wisdom at that time was that oil would quickly weather, quickly be reduced to a tar-like hard substance that would no longer be toxic, and it turns out that those assumptions were not true. And I think that goes to the whereas clause.
Okay.
On line 8 of page 3. The reopener clause requires that we submitted a detailed plan. The deadline is September 1, 2006, and the whereas clause on line 18, I think, is just a general statement of intent.
So do you know whether or not there's any movement within the administration to submit or to try to gather the information necessary for the plan for a reopener?
They have, the administration, Mr. Chairman, has conducted hearings in Cordova, in Anchorage, and in other locations on Kodiak.
Kodiak, yes.
Thank you. And so that certainly indicates some movement. What their final intention is, I can't speak to, and I'm I guess hopeful that the resolution will have some effect on their decision.
How recently did they have the hearings?
Less than a month ago.
Okay, so it indicates that they're at least
doing something.
Also aware,
yeah,
of the,
yeah, yeah,
of aware, the deadline. Okay, and when they had the hearings, who conducted them? Was it DNR, Department of Law? Who do you remember?
I did. Pardon me.
Mark, what is
it? Department of Law.
Department of Law did. Okay. Well, and what were they really looking for as they were doing that? Were either of you at any?
I wasn't at any of the hearing or the one hearing in Kodiak. I believe Representative Thomas attended a hearing in Cordova.
Okay.
But I think that basically what it was they were looking for people who were in the area to testify as to what's still wrong there.
Okay. All right. So what we're doing then is we're saying we don't want Congress to intervene with any legislation that would reduce or delay payment. And we want Department of Justice and Alaska Department of Law to identify all natural resource damages. Okay. I'm taking it face value, and I have no reason not to, that the data that we've looked at is correct. It's the one thing I hate about resolutions. One of the things that I hate about findings of fact, and is that I'm sometimes a little shy on the fact, because you don't have the opportunity to verify them yourself. But I want to, on the record, make sure that we have examined the facts, and at least someone has been able to convince me within a reasonable boundary that they're correct. So, Senator Huggins?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question for the sponsor is whether or not you see any value in looking at doing this in a coordinated effort with administration, or are you going to do it more unilaterally?
Well, I mean, what this amendment does, or what this resolution does, is just tell the administration that this is the will of the legislature. This is what the legislature would like to see done. I'd be certainly, you know, willing to work with the administration if the administration is interested in doing so, in trying to work together to get something going.
Well, it goes well beyond that. Says it's sent to the President of the United States. So, I mean, my question, if we as a state are delivering the message, do you want to deliver it with the governor or in spite of him? Or
well,
I mean, I ask that, you know, very sincerely. This is not a trap.
Mm-hmm. No, if I may.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's simply a recognition of the different branches of government, and it's a way for us to formalize, if you will, an expression of will to the other branch. You know, it's, I guess I see it as cooperative, but it's, you know, since we are a separate branch, we can only communicate with them, I guess, in certain stylized ways, and this is one of them. Or not that we can only do it, but this is one of the more formal ways for us to urge action and to offer support should they choose to take it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I don't know. As I see it, it's got multiple addressees, if you look at the last paragraph, and, you know, my assumption, we as a state want as unified as message as we can. I'm not saying we have to group with the governor or anybody else. I just ask the question to see if we want to deliberately do that or deliberately not do it.
Well, from my perspective, I think that we should be doing it as this body, but I would also hope that the administration delivers a similar message.
And my final comment is that it might be at least worth our time just to make sure we're not disagreeing on the facts, if there are some facts. I mean, the governor's held some public meetings. I'm not saying we have to agree with the governor, we have to accept the facts, but if we're sending messages outside our state, I think it would be nice if our facts were similar, or we resolve the difference, or we just agree to disagree. And I have not been to any public hearings. I don't have an axe to grind on this. I happen to agree with the gist of the resolution. I just want us to do whatever's the best for the state and the regions involved.
And that's my intention also.
Yeah. Let's go ahead, Senator.
But anyway, just it's my recommendation that the fact check be run, and that we're not sending mixed messages if there are going to be dual messages that go out of here.
No problem with that. I think we can do that. Let's listen to, we've got three people that wanted to testify. Let's hear them this morning. Now let's start in Cordova with Tim Joyce. Tim, are you still online with us?
Yes, I am.
If you'll once again introduce yourself for the record, sir, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, staff members, and members of the public. My name is Tim Joyce, and I'm mayor in the city of Cordova. I've listened to your testimony yesterday and this morning on these two bills, and I want to stress that these two bills can be combined, but they are two separate issues. One is dealing with the actual spill punitive damages, and the other one is dealing with a reopener clause for continued exploration of ways to resolve unanticipated damages and issues that are a result of the oil spill. But I think you can do that as long as that's completely identified. The HJR 9, which I plan to testify to this morning as I testified to SJR 17 yesterday, is a little bit out of date in that things have obviously gone on since last year, such as you heard this morning that the oral arguments have already been heard on this for the circuit court. But I do want to let you know that I recently, just last week, returned from Washington, D.C., where we were talking to congressmen from around the country, different parts of the country, informing them about the Exxon Valdez oil spill litigation and its progress or delay. And there is a letter that is circulating through the House of Representatives right now, collecting signatures from the House members to the chairman of Exxon Mobil Corporation. And if you'll indulge me, it's a one-page letter. I'd like to read this letter to you. It's from Congressman Reichert, who is out of Washington. And it says, "Dear Mr. Tillerson, who is now the chairman of Exxon Mobil, We are writing to urge ExxonMobil to finally resolve the protracted litigation resulting from the disastrous events of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. 17 years ago this month, ExxonMobil left an intoxicated captain at the helm of the oil tanker ship Exxon Valdez, even though it knew he had a drinking problem. The Valdez ran aground on Bly Reef, spilling 11 million gallons of crude oil into Prince William Sound, a body of water long prized for its natural beauty and valuable resources. 12 years ago, a jury in federal court awarded damages to 33,000 commercial fishermen, Alaska Native people, small businesses, and communities devastated by the spill. As the new chairman and CEO of ExxonMobil, one who enjoys the good fortune of taking over at a time when ExxonMobil has posted the largest annual profit ever recorded by a U.S. company, we encourage you to take advantage of this occasion to chart a new course for your company. You have a unique opportunity to improve the image of your company and, more importantly, do what is right by the victims of the Valdez disaster. In 1994, a unanimous federal jury ordered ExxonMobil to pay punitive damages to the thousands of people injured by the spill. Over the next 12 years, the federal judge managing the case has reaffirmed on no fewer than three separate occasions the jury's decision to award punitive damages in light of ExxonMobil's conduct. The judgment now stands at $4.5 billion. In his most recent opinion, the judge emphasized that ExxonMobil's continued protest, and I quote, suggests that Exxon, even today, has not come to grips with the opprobrium that society rightly attaches to drunk driving. End quote. What has ExxonMobil done? While the company has paid for the value of the lost fish, it has never compensated the plaintiffs for their other continuing damages, including, in the words of the trial judge, the fact that, quote, the social fabric of Prince William Sound and Lower Cook Inlet was torn apart, end quote. Instead, ExxonMobil employed one primary tactic, delay. Over the course of the past 17 years, ExxonMobil has filed nearly 400 motions and over a dozen appeals, successfully prolonging the litigation beyond all reasonable limits. In the meantime, thousands of the company's victims have died without obtaining the damages to which they were entitled. While ExxonMobil posted a $36 billion profit last year alone. Normally, we do not comment on ongoing litigation, but these delayed tactics are irresponsible and indefensible. It has now been 17 years since one of the worst environmental disasters of our nation's history, and nearly 12 years since the jury verdict. It is time ExxonMobil faces up to its corporate responsibility, closes this dark chapter in your company's history, and ends this undue burden on the victims and the courts. We call on ExxonMobil to resolve the litigation by paying the damages awarded to the victims of the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Very truly yours, and it will be signed by many members of the House of Representatives. This was a dear colleague letter that was going around. I believe there was at least 20 members that were signing this letter that I know of when I left Washington, D.C. And I think that that is something now that in these resolutions that you are sending out, that you should also urge Exxon to become the good corporate neighbor and to end this litigation proceedings and to pay the bills that they were justly judged to have been cited to pay. At any rate, I do know that our own legislators, our own congressional delegation supports this letter. I do know that they have also been working behind the scenes to try to get resolution to this. And I urge our own state legislature to do the same thing. Thank you very much.
Questions for Mr. Joyce?
Yeah.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a comment. Mayor Joyce, Charlie Huggins here from Wasilla. Just wanted to pass on from both Joe Fields and Bill Thomas, thanks for the leadership you've shown for the celebration for Vietnam veterans this summer.
Oh, you bet, sir. I don't know how much I enjoy doing that. I think that's a great opportunity for people here to pay their respects for the Vietnam veterans that served. And Cordova had probably one of the highest per capita death rates in Vietnam. You know, we don't have a large population, but we did have three boys here that were killed. So I'm very happy to be able to do that.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. So we've got a couple of little different numbers. We got 15 we scratched, and then we had 16, and this letter says 17.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator French?
Maybe just as a maybe we should adopt this to start working on it. Should we do that?
Are you moving to adopt G as a working document?
As a working document, yes.
Is there objection?
Hearing none.
Now, are we on page 2, lines 26 and 27?
Yep. We got 20, we had 15, we scratched that, we get in 16, the letter says 17.
I think the accurate number is 17.
And then over farther, we had scratched 10, we put in 11, and now we're, that letter said 12.
September 94, I don't think it's quite 12 yet. I think
almost.
I would
nearly. How about nearly 12?
I'll take the chairman's offer as a friendly amendment to nearly 12.
And we had $4.5 billion in damages in that letter, and $5.3 billion in our resolution. Wonder which is which.
I hold on. Let me see what my law review article says.
Let's take just a quick recess, short recess. Back on the record. I didn't hear any other challenges to the facts act. Let's go to Ken Adams in Cordova next. Mr. Adams, are you still with us there?
Yes. Is that Mr. Chairman Seeger?
Yes, it is.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning, and if you'll reintroduce yourself for the members, we'll be eager to hear your testimony, sir.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm Ken Adams. I live in Cordova. I am a fisherman, stakeholder, have been dependent upon Prince William Sound and the Copper River Delta for my existence, my financial existence. And I appreciated yesterday the opportunity to comment with respect to SJR 17. And I'd like to continue on today with respect to HJR 09. And I don't have any objection to melding these two resolutions if the sponsors also feel that this is the most expedient way to proceed. So if I may proceed, I'll just offer some comments with respect to HJR 09 separate, as I've already offered comments yesterday to SJR 17. Basically, I urge your support for the maintenance of the judicial process without interruption. And I feel that that the punitive damage case needs to go forward. And I'll mention just a couple of comments why I think this is so. I think there have been examples of operational negligence shown by various corporations dealing with the extraction and transportation of Alaska crude oil, and even to the involvement of some of these companies out of state with respect to refining the same products. There have been examples of egregious disregard for maintenance and for operational safety. And it is apparent that the symptoms, that these are symptoms, I think, of a problem, that perhaps the powerful industries, the powerful energy industries these days, may feel that they can darn well do as they please and not be held responsible for their actions. And the relatively meager of fines paid for their transgressions be considered maybe nothing more than just the cost of doing business. If that is true, if that is the way that business is being conducted these days, I think maintenance of this punitive damage award with Exxon go forward without interruption. And I think it can set an example. It can gain the attention. And it is not only gain the attention of the other corporations that do business with the state of Alaska. And I say that it is not only appropriate that this be done, but it is essential that this be done. It is essential that there be a deterrent for sloppy, negligent industrial practices that threaten the stakeholders and the environments of Alaska that we do indeed hold dear. And the fact also is that we here in Prince William Sound are going to be forever on the interface between two seemingly incompatible industries. One that is involved with the transporting of crude oil through the Sound, and also the apparent contrasting industry of communities which depend upon a clean, safe environment for which to extract the fisheries, or for which this area is famous. So what I'm saying is, I think we really need to go forward with this punitive damage case without interruption to really bring to the attention that, hey boys, pay attention, and don't just write us off as a cost of doing business, but there are serious consequences for your disregard for operational safety. And Mr. Joyce mentioned the case of a tanker operator, tanker captain, who had a drinking problem, and the disregard for that condition, putting that individual in such a role of authority. And we know what the consequences are of that failure. So anyway, I not to make a long story, but I think I made my point that this is a deterrent this punitive damage award is a deterrent, and we really need to get the attention of the industries. And there are examples, as I said, of laxity and neglect, and I think that's only going to come back to bite us as a state. And I fully recognize the difficulties and the sort of incongruities we have within the state, because we are certainly an oil state. We depend upon the revenues, and we're happen to be in a good condition these days with respect to royalties and taxes gained from the industry. And I'm not knocking that. You can't knock that. But let's call for business to be conducted in a safe and responsible manner. And I think pursuing this punitive damage award will do that. It'll bring to the attention of the industry, hey boys, pay attention. And gentlemen, I thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Adams, for being here this morning. Let's go to the off-nets next. We have Lloyd Montgomery online. Lloyd, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm Lloyd Montgomery. I had an opportunity to go back, but Tim Joyce back to D.C., and it was by accident I was able to go by an invitation of Mikey Maxwell, who was not able to go because of his health and getting ready to go commercial fishing, so I was really privileged to go back there and work with Tim Joyce. And while we were back there, Washington Advocates is part of it, as well as our attorney. But it was quite an experience. After I came back, I was able to gather my thoughts and go over what had happened. There was so much that had happened so fast and such a short, quick time that it's off the yard to still believe that I even went back there to D.C. But first of all, April 9th, I was at one of the hearings that you can have access to any local TV station, KTUU, and there are others that have recorded everything that was said and done, and so that's one option if you'd like to get more information on them. But also, too, while we're back, we shared some of our experiences along with Tim Joyce, and also, too, sent back a message from Olympic gold medalist Seth Westcott and his feelings. And at the end of the press conference, which Tim Joyce was not there available, but this lady from Ohio, which is a judge and one of the congressmen, had really lashed out against Exxon and that it's time to get this taken care of. And I really appreciated what she said, because going back to the judges and walking through the halls of our country, the Capitol and the Lincoln Memorial, you know, I can't really help but think of these great men like Ernest Greening and other people who are part of our country and the way it come to about with trust and integrity. And I can honestly say that those responsible, the judges, and also to the responsibility of the Exxon representatives that have kept us going, I ask myself, how can they walk through the hall of our the capital of our nation and actually walk through it there with pride? You know, how can they walk through there with conscience at all, stating that they did such a good thing for, you know, for the plaintiffs here, which is totally devastated our monetary and our environment? And speaking about our environment, is I know for a fact that at that hearing on April 9th, I testified that Dan DeMont was sitting next to an oceanographist who had a PhD that back in 1990 was picking up oil 600 feet deep, and Exxon came by and asked the NOAA to leave, and they left the next day. And Dan DeMont is a God-fearing man, and he left a business card with our attorney and stating that fact, that what I just repeated to you there. And I also mentioned too back there, while we're sitting at Lisa Murkowski's desk, that they're basically caught in the middle. Governor Murkowski and Lisa Murkowski are caught in the middle. Previously before that, 3 weeks ago, before we went back there, they had sent a letter to Exxon stating that it's time to take care of this. And the comment was, Lisa Murkowski was that Exxon sent a letter back to go fly a kite in a real nice manner. I wouldn't even want to repeat what she said. But the experience I had back there was, I shared with them that Exxon has basically held us in captivity in 17 years of a mental holocaust. And at the end of the conference there, there was a man that came up to me. None of the local TV stations would approach me, but this one man from NPR, whatever you call it, came up to me and asked me what my clock represented. What the representative was, I did this clock hanging on the wall back in 1990, and on it I had put on their frustration, segregation, and suicide, and loss of economy, and also one I had on there that kind of kid around with loss of hair, which I do have. But then I asked him, I says, what would have happened if during the blossom of the cherry trees that were brought over, the Japanese brought over, I said, what would happen hypothetically if a horticulturist came along and sprayed all these trees and they were all dead? And the one that did that said, oh, don't worry about it. We're going to take care of it. We're going to make you whole. And you wait 17 years for those trees to come back to life. And the comment the man made was, they wouldn't have waited that long. Well, Alaska's out of sight, out of mind compared to Katrina. And also, too, I had mentioned there that I said the frustration that they're having with tight security back in D.C., I said, Nina Collier, the Alaska advocate, took us to the president's mansion there. We walked about and I said, how are the feelings back there in Washington, D.C.? And she said, the tension, the anxiety is so bad back there, it's unreal, the security. There are 24-hour sirens going every day. I mean, like a van came up accidentally and was going to unload a wash machine, and the man was down on the ground with the policemen surrounded. And I said, you know what? That is what Cordova's been going through. Basically, for 17 years. And what does Cordova and Prince Sound deserve? What have we done to deserve it? Set, heartless, cruel company. Excuse me, but this is hard. Oh, boy. I've been doing fine for 17 years so lately, but... Oh, boy, this is embarrassing. Man, I hope you forgive me, but, boy, it's been a really emotional time for the last couple of weeks here. And having to go back there and do the best I could and share the suicides and the bankruptcies and the lingering oil after effects. And I'll give you a perfect example. Yesterday, there was a lawsuit filed against the Stainers, and that's kind of a lingering oil effect. If it wasn't for the Exxon oil spill, we wouldn't be in this position now. We wouldn't have been going to court. And I told John Ursulip, I said, John Ursulip, it's awfully hard for me to be sitting here at the table with you as a Stainer and a Gilman representative, but I said, we have to pull through this and do the best we can with what we've got. But it was really difficult, but I just wanted to share with you, Your Honor, that this is what I experienced, and like I said, Lisa McCoskey and Ted Stevens are caught in the middle, and they're trying to do the best they can for the economy of Alaska and whatever they're doing, and it was a good time to be back there, and an honor to work with Tim Joyce. The night that we went for dinner, he came out with his Cordova hat, and he represented Cordova. I never seen anybody so proud.
Any questions for Mr. Montgomery? Seeing none, Mr. Montgomery, thank you very much for being with us this morning. We appreciate your testimony.
Just one more thing, please.
Sure.
May I share with you?
Sure.
And also, too, while we're sitting at Lisa McCoskey's desk, I said, after walking through the Washington Museum Capitol there in the mall and seeing all of the Smithsonian Institute and exhibits, and I said, there's one exhibit that's missing back there in D.C., and that's the Exxon oil spill. And what it has done monetarily and also, too, economically and environmentally, it needs to be really, there really needs to be an exhibit back there in Washington, D.C., as well as in Cordova, for the tourists to see what the Exxon Valdez has done to Prince William Sound, as well as other places in Anchorage, what Exxon has done. So that's what I'd like to share with you. Apologize for losing it the way I did, but thank you again for taking my phone call, and I appreciate it. And, and hope you consider what we are working for here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your time. Okay, we've got public testimony out of the way. We do have a couple of proposed amendments here. We'll amend it now. And let's take a look at line 24 on page 2. I propose that we change the number 5.3 at this point to 4.5.
I'll make that motion.
Is there objection? Amendment number 1 to change 4.5 to 4.5 from 5.3. Next proposed amendment, line 26. Propose delete 15, insert 17.
I'll make that motion. Okay. You want to do it as one? Or
one line here.
I withdraw.
And then after the word comma and, we'll delete more than and insert nearly. Delete 10 and insert 12. So it would read, and delete nearly as the second word. So the line would read, whereas 17 years after the disaster and nearly a
And nearly 12?
12 years after the original jury verdict, the victims are still waiting. Okay? Is that your motion?
I'll move that.
Is there objection? Number 2, let's see. Was the punitive damages the $5 billion number?
Yes.
Okay. The 4.5 is the awarded actual damages, right? Plus interest.
That's my understanding, yeah. But we'll make sure we double check.
What we'll do is we'll ask that those numbers just be verified. Get into the rules. Are there any other proposed amendments? Senator French?
Mr. Chairman, I would just point out that I greatly appreciated the folks that testified here today, but I guess maybe in going to some of Senator Huggins' concerns, that I just would point out that this resolution makes no mention of Exxon profits, makes no mention of intoxication, and tries to steer, a middle path on this contentious subject.
Yeah, no, I mean, don't get me wrong. That to me, I mean, Exxon should be held fully accountable. I mean, I quite frankly, the playground for lawyers is my concern of this, because this isn't about Exxon. It's not about Alaska. It's about what lawyers can do with our process. I mean, I just say that very candidly. Should Exxon be held accountable? Should they pay up? Absolutely. Mr. Lloyd Montgomery from Cordova, I think, is typical of Alaskans who are very frustrated by the legal system, by the people of the legal system, holding them hostage. That frustrates me. So, you know, should Exxon pay up? Absolutely. The reason they're not paying up is our legal system won't allow us to get to it.
All right.
Point taken.
Are there any other amendments? Seeing none.
I move that Senate CS for House Joint Resolution Number 9 be forwarded out of committee with spell checks on facts.
And individual recommendations. All right. Thank you very much. And we will, this is, without objection, it's on its way to the next committee. There's nothing else today to come before the committee. The committee will meet daily at the call of the chair. We're adjourned.